Howdy there. You're back. Thanks. Jackie, you want to tell the people what's up?
Hey, y'all. On this episode of To and Fro, we hear from Associate Professor at Rutgers University, Dr. Brittany Cooper, about her book, Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower.
I also stopped by the first Curly Girl Picnic at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas, and talked to blogger, influencer, and picnic creator Coco Bates about the event and more. Okay, so Jackie, are you ready?
We have watched From the Mountains.
All right.
As your technological advances have been overseen by a child.
Has anybody ever told you that you look like Shuri?
By this old man who could not keep his own father.
Has anybody told you? Has anybody told you that?
I said we will not have it.
All right.
I said we. Pause. You know he liked my comment on Instagram.
Wait, pause. You know that you look like Shuri, right?
I know my brother told me that.
You do.
Multiple people have told me, I'm sure.
When she was being annoying on screen, I totally.
Multiple people. I mean, and that's fine because she's the smartest girl in the Marvel Universe. Like,
anyway.
Whatever. No, but back to what I was saying about me and my husband, Winston Duke.
He posted a picture
with Tessa Thompson.
I'm not putting this in the show.
Yes, you are, because you have to let the world know. So he posted a picture with Tessa Thompson, and he, like, called her beautiful or something. And I commented, and I said, when I'm so secure in us, I don't have to worry about you complimenting other women. He liked that comment. So he recognizes that there is an us between me and him.
He recognizes that there is a mentally ill woman.
No. He liked my comment because he was like, yeah, that's my bae.
All right, can we start the show?
Whatever, I guess.
I don't have a bad attitude. Maybe I am angry inside. I've been through stuff, so I'm angry.
Yes, but this is not okay. Be quiet.
I have never in my life yelled at a girl like this. When my mother yells at this, it's because she loves me. I was rooting for you. We were all rooting for you. How dare you? Learn something from this.
I interviewed Dr. Brittany Cooper, who is an associate professor of women's and gender studies and Africana studies at Rutgers University. She is a co-founder of the popular Crunk Feminist Collective blog and also the author of the recently released Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower. And Jackie, I have to say, this was a pretty interesting conversation.
I can't wait to hear about it. And so to begin, Dr. Cooper explains exactly what Eloquent Rage is.
Eloquent Rage is it's something that one of my students used to describe me many years ago. She had been sitting in one of my lectures or a series of lectures, and she said, you know, I loved hearing you lecture because your lectures were filled with rage, but it was like the most eloquent rage ever. And I was immediately defensive when she characterized me in that way. She was a young Black woman student, but I was worried about the angry Black woman stereotype and assumed that she was trying to stereotype me as angry. And she sort of pinned me with this look and said, you know, you're angry, when I denied it. I denied it. And I said to her, I'm not angry, I'm passionate. And she just sort of looked at me and said, you know, you're angry. And it was this moment of reckoning and truth telling that I couldn't deny. And it helped me to begin to think about my anger differently. So no, I don't want Black women to be dismissed because of the angry Black woman stereotype. But I do want us to be able to reclaim our right to be angry, to have rage, to be mad as hell at the politics that we face every day, a world and a culture that often doesn't value us, the ways that we do all of the work to hold our families and our communities and the institutions in which we work and which we care about. We hold those places down, and often we are deeply devalued, and that is rage inducing. And then we, you know, suppress all of that rage because we don't want to be dismissed as merely being angry. And that is deeply unhealthy. And so I wanted us to think in a healthy, productive way about what it meant to both own our anger and then be able to channel it and use it in ways that felt helpful for us.
You got the right to be mad.
So when you sing, it's okay. But when I sing, it's an issue.
Because I am Beyonce.
Girl, out of us?
You what? I'm sorry.
Huh? You got
hear
it.
Me.
You, First of all, I mean, who got their tickets like before Jackie, you? Jackie, got their tickets before you?
Jackie, you're getting off a subject. I just want to let you know right now, I'm going to go ahead and put this out there. I feel like me and you are like Jay-Z and Beyonce. You know, nobody comes for Jay-Z. They come for Beyonce.
What?
And that's a lie. I feel like, but listen, I feel like we're like a mimosa. You know what I'm saying? Nobody comes for the orange juice. They come for the champagne, which is me. And I think that you need to go ahead and accept that.
I actually like fruit punch mimosas.
All right. Anyway, back to the topic.
So, Dalia, what is this right to be mad that you struggled with growing up?
Oh, yes, girl. Okay, so like, whenever I was growing up, I don't know if you've ever felt this, but do you ever feel like in white spaces that you constantly like have to have your walls up and like you just like got a bad attitude? And you know what? It took me actually like growing up to realize like why I was so always pissed off and why like as a black woman, I was outraged by a lot of the like just like the white mentality around me. How about you?
No, yeah, I definitely agree. And it's really hard to trust white people because sometimes you let them in and then they do something like really racist and you're just like, wow, I thought I could trust you. Like, I really thought that I could trust you. I really thought that I was safe being here and being myself. And then you're laughing. I mean, I'm dead serious.
I know you are.
You're like, wow, I really thought I could trust you. I really thought that we could be like transparent with each other. And then it's just like they let you down.
Yeah, I totally feel that on a whole nother level.
Yeah, and Dr. Cooper explains this right to harness the anger or outrage through her own experience throughout her journey to label herself as a feminist.
I'm from a small southern town in North Louisiana, and my family members live in Shreveport, Louisiana, which is not too far from the, you know, East Texas border. And I say that to say, you know, I'm not from the urban South. I grew up in the country, so I consider myself a girl with deeply rural roots, and a church girl, and I'm a preacher's kid, among many other things. So I do understand, but I think that what I care most about and the reason that I'm a feminist is because feminism is not about playing nice. It is about being disruptive. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to burn everything down. It doesn't mean that you have to cuss everybody out. But it does mean that you get to have a perspective that isn't about trying to go along to get along. That kind of politic is killing Black women. And part of what this book celebrates, I mean, it celebrates all of the women in my family, the women who raised me, women who were and are rural country Black women who I've seen do this with a level of finesse that I think in some ways comes from the fact that they haven't been in these sort of mainstream institutions in the same way. I think a lot of the like angst the angst that we have about this often comes from overachieving Black girls who have a lot to lose if we show that we're angry. And so my grandmother and my mother taught me a whole lot about how to read people, both to in what I mean by that is to interpret them, but also in the contemporary way we mean it, to read them for filth without, you know, letting a hair get out of place. And so in some ways, this book is a celebration of that and a way to say our rage is righteous, but that doesn't mean that you have to show out unless it's necessary. It does mean that you get to acknowledge that the way that we get treated is not okay and that we have the right to fight back, but that we have all kinds of tools in our arsenal for what it looks like to fight back. And so it doesn't look like, when I say eloquent, I don't mean that we have to be loud and rowdy or, you know, uncouth, if it's a thing that's going to cost you. But I do mean that when we see Black women who are being loud and rowdy and uncouth, I'm always of the opinion that they're probably more right than wrong. And then what does it look like to hear them and to hear the things that they're angry about? So look, I didn't grow up with women who even knew what the word feminism meant, let alone call themselves that. And so that is absolutely language that I got when I got particularly to a PhD program. So I want to own that. But what I did grow up with was women who said things to me, like my grandmother, who said, you know, look, I don't ever want to get married again, right? I don't ever want a man to tell me, you know, what I can do with my money or what groceries to buy for my house. That's a feminist sentiment. The idea that like Black women should have some control over their lives, a say so, you know, mind you. So it's a very distinct thing from the sort of thing you hear down South, particularly if you're a church girl, that's like a man is the head of the family. A man is the head of the household. This is God's way. My grandmother was an usher. She was a deeply devout woman. She raised all of us to be very devout. And at the same time, she was like, look, some of that pragmatically does not work. It is very hard and undesirable and not the way that I choose to live my life when I have choices about how I want to live. And my mother was also incredibly independent. And I love to tell the story about the fact that my mother is a preacher's wife. My stepdad is a pastor. And my mama keeps, they have their house together where they live, but my mama keeps her own house up and running in a totally separate city, the one she had before she married him. And she is just like, look, I will always have something in my name, some property, a bank account that doesn't have anything to do with him or this relationship. And all of that, that sort of independent spirit, that sense that women should be able to position themselves for the life they want, to have choices and to have freedom that is not tethered to a man, even when you have a good man, even when you have a good partner, all of that is feminist. And so I had the models for it, and then I got the language for it.
This thought of Dr. Cooper saying, although the women in her family weren't feminists, they had very, like, feministic, if that's even a word, feministic qualities. So, like, you know, for example, she talks about, like, some of her family members, like her own mom, and, you know, how she was just, like, independent and all that. And I can say that I truly do identify with what Dr. Cooper was saying in that sense, because I, being raised by, like, a strong, very strong panel of, like, matriarchs. Like, I had kind of father figures in my life, but it was always the women who always overcame. It was always the women who were providing, and it was always the women who were taking care of their children, no matter what, regardless if there was a man in and out of, you know, our lives as kids, especially with my mom. And I feel like even though my mom wouldn't even call herself a feminist, or my grandma wouldn't, I mean, at the end of the day, they do have those feminist qualities where they do believe that, you know, women should be treated equally, or they do believe that women should have their own. How about you?
No, I definitely agree. And my family is the same way. We've never really had a patriarch in our family. It's always been a matriarch. My dad was definitely around, but the majority of my figures were women. And it's crazy because me and my mom just had this conversation where she's like, you were raised by such strong women, and like that quality comes out of you, and sometimes it can be a little overbearing. And it's just that's what I've learned. I've learned that I have to be a strong woman. When I look up to my role models, I don't really look up to any men. I look up to strong women, because I've seen my family. I've seen the women in my family, and they definitely wouldn't label themselves as a feminist, because I think growing up they kind of had maybe a negative connotation towards it. When you look at their lives and you look at the things that they've done and the things they overcame and the true things that they believe in, they definitely are feminist, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's like being raised by a tribe, right? And I think for our background, especially for like Black Southern women, that's exactly how Black Southern women raise their kids, right? It takes a village for them to raise that. And I think that was the mentality that I grew up in. I didn't expect any more. Like, I didn't expect less from Black women. You know, I always knew that we were the ones to take care of any issue, no matter what happened in our family, regardless if it came to money, you know what I mean? Regardless of anything, the women in my lives are always the one to take care of it.
Definitely same.
Kind of moving on with this conversation, you know, throughout her book, Dr. Cooper talks about, you know, being raised with these matriarchs, but she also talks about being a young Southerner growing up in like a really rural town in the middle of Louisiana. And some of the things that she went through kind of sound familiar to myself.
Oh my God, it was terrible. You know, I mean, I got bullied for my entire childhood and called white girl everywhere. At home, my cousins called me white girl, all the Black kids at school. I mean, it was, what I want to affirm for any Black girl who feels that way is that it is actually terrible, and that you're not crazy for feeling that way. And that sometimes it's a function of people having limited models of other ways to be Black, other ways to think about Blackness. And so for me, part of what I knew as a kid, even when I was in the thick of it, and the thing that helped me to hold on, was that this is no knock to small town living, but one of the reasons that I don't choose to make my home in the small town I grew up with is because I needed to be in a place where Black people had more opportunities and therefore a more expansive worldview about what was possible. And so what I knew as a kid was that even though I didn't find my tribe of people in my school and in my community. I knew they were out there. I knew that there were nerdy Black girls who were real crunk and who, you know, who didn't hate being Black, who were like, no, we Black, we love it. But also, like, we're into, you know, all this random stuff, random novels and random kinds of music and all of that. I knew that those Black girls existed. And so for me, I started to find them in college. I started to find some of them in grad school. And so when I encounter kids like that in my own hometown, you know, I just say to them, like, you might have to leave to find a little bit of community. And I think that in doing so, it allows me to move with a bit more ease in my own community. Because the other thing that happened is that I sort of reconciled, like, you know, there's a thing that happens when you grow up like that, where you do start to look at other Black people and have, sometimes you can have a negative view. And I just got to move out into the world and see that there were all kinds of Black people, to really appreciate that. And the more that I moved out into the broader world and was able to sort of expand, then I also came to have a deep appreciation for the Black folks who raised me and the ways in which they weren't always overly sophisticated and cosmopolitan, right? But they were certainly deeply wise and insightful about people. And the thing that you come to learn on the flip side, once you have moved out and you have built a life for yourself, is that people are still people, you know. And so I think I'm saying to you that in the midst of that, in the midst of the bullying and the being talked crazy to and being disaffirmed, then you feel absolutely crazy. And the solution for that is to hold on and to know that you are not wrong, that there's nothing wrong about you. You just are who you are. But also to know that the thing that will make that better is that you've got to search intensely for your crew, rather than assuming that you're the only one that is like you in the world. That is not true. They're all, you know, once my first day at Howard University, I was like, well, who are all these smart? Oh my God. Like, you know, it was like a healing for all of the times when I felt like there were no Black people who understood my experience or my life. And so that's what I would say to folks, is find your crew, find your tribe, be diligent, be vigilant about it. You know, but also I just want to affirm that it is hard, that experience is very, very hard. But you can get through it. You know, you can get through it with a supportive community and with having a little bit of vision for your life and who you want to be, and what kind of things are possible. And so, and if your parents raising kids struggling with things like this, the thing that my mama did, even as a single mama, is she was like, look, baby, I owed everybody in town, but I was going to make sure that you went on these trips. And swim team was your thing. Debate team was my thing. And that's where I was with all the little nerdy white kids. And she was like, you know, but I'm going to, you know, whatever, you know, you're going to go to these camps and I'm going to send you on these trips. And we're going to, you know, and so I would just say to parents who have kids who are really struggling, the thing they need to know is that that there is a community of kids who are like them. And so whatever resources you can marshal to give them experiences outside of the immediate environment to affirm those gifts in them, it will make a world of difference, you know, in the years to come.
So my elementary school and my private school were Black, definitely. Mm-hmm. But when I went to middle school, there was this weird thing that happened to where I was supposed to go to a predominantly Black middle school, but they ended up switching the zonings and I went to a predominantly white middle school. It was new. They did not want us there. Let me just throw that out there. But I was literally surrounded by a lot of white kids. And so it's dealing with certain things, dealing with just kind of knowing that you're in a place where you don't really, where people don't even want you there, and dealing with the ideas that their white parents taught them and how those transferred like onto us. Like, I specifically mm-hmm. remember like the tension that there was when Obama was first elected president. And it's mm-hmm. crazy because people think at that age you're not even aware of it, but you mm-hmm. are. Like, you're aware that you're in this space that isn't necessarily for you. So when I went to high school, I did go to a predominantly Black high school. And honestly, it was like a little bit of a culture shock because I was like, wow, like I haven't been around this many Black people in a while. Like, mm-hmm. as far as like school, like, of course, like church, community, all of that. But school wise, it was just completely different. And so it's just that transition of being somewhere where you're not wanted and being somewhere where you know that this isn't a space for you, but somehow having to find and pull from those groups of communities to pull together to be like, okay, this is where all the black kids are and we're going to stick together.
Yeah.
Versus like being surrounded by black people and seeing like the different types of black people and things like that. What about
you? Yeah, I think for me, it was actually the opposite of you. I had always grown up in these like predominantly white spaces whenever I was like in elementary, whenever I was in pre-K and all of that. And I think that for me, it was like, even though I had been raised in all these spaces, I still didn't know how to navigate. Like I still feel alienated. Like that alienation, no matter how much you think that you're used to it, it's going to always stick there. And I remember like whenever I was going through my, you know how like as a black girl, you always go through this process where you at one point thought whiteness was good, right? Like
we
thought being the closer to whiteness.
Because that's the way we were socialized.
That's the way that
we
were socialized. Yeah. Exactly. And so like I was going through that phase through like middle school and like maybe like my freshman year of high school where I was trying to associate myself with these white groups because I didn't want to be, you know, deemed as like a bad kid because I was a geek, right? I was just like this nerdy black girl who liked to read and who liked to do all these other things. And like there were times where I didn't fit in with the black community that was at my school. You know what I'm saying? Like, and Dr. Cooper kind of talks about how that's on account of a lot of people, especially in the rural South, not being exposed to different types of blackness, right? Mm-hmm. And so it took me, like me and my friends have been friends for maybe more than 10 years now. And we didn't really stick together until we were in our like upper class of high school where we were, you know, on student council together. We were making good grades. We were in the advanced classes together and everybody would kind of label us as the white kids for being the nerdy black kids. And it kind of took me going outside of like high school and going into college to really recognize the nuances of what being black is and to kind of find my tribe and to kind of like appreciate what my blackness represents.
Yeah, I was just about to say that. I was about to be like, if we're just keeping it like a book, I feel like I really didn't get comfortable with my blackness until I got into college because it's just like you're exposed to so many different people. And I understand what you're talking about as far as like the geek blacks. I was always on the, I could always like code switch into both because I would be in AP classes, but then like I would still have some classes like with, you know, like the cool black kids, but I would let them cheat off my paper so they thought I was a little cool. But I was cool in high school.
No, I wasn't.
Some people hated me, but I was still cool. So it was like I was able to teeter totter between that line, but sometimes you still kind of feel pulled because it's like I don't want to seem too geeky because then I'm not gonna fit in.
Yeah.
But in reality, like girl, I would stand up all night reading books. Like I was a geek. I still am. Yeah. And so it's not until you get into college where you just kind of get to step away from this bubble that you kind of been in and you get to realize like, wow, like this is going to sound a little crazy, but like there's more out there, you know, and there's more people out there and it's a whole sea of people that you haven't even imagined. You haven't even touched. You don't even know who they are. So,
Now, Jackie, we kind of talk about this experience like growing up in school, and I kind of want to encompass that into another part of the conversation me and Dr. Cooper had. She talks about white women and she talks about white women and feminism specifically in the book, but she also talks about growing up around white girls and around white women in this kind of aspect where we are not accepted by this particular population, but we are always compared to them. And it was very interesting.
I try to talk about this complicated relationship I have with white women. I say that really upfront because I think that black women are deeply insightful. And I talk about Hillary Clinton, the 2016 elections is one way to get at this. But one of the things that I sort of say is, look, like black women are very clear about the ways that white women weaponize white femininity against black men and also against black women so that they get to be the victims, even when they have been often the ones doing very racist things. There's a way in which they're not held accountable, and that lack of accountability happens at the expense of black people. And I think that we should say that and be very forthright about it. And at the same time, just like the experiences we're describing, particularly if you grow up in the South, you still have lots of contact with white folks. You know, you're working with them, your kids are in school with them. If they're kids like us, they're friends with them and going to their houses and bringing white folk home and things like that. And so I think that what we have learned in terms of being in culturally close proximity is that there is a way that you can both have a very clear picture of white people's racism and sometimes their refusal to acknowledge it or deal with it. And at the same time, not always dismiss every white person simply because they have racially problematic attitudes. I think the reality is that the vast majority of white folks, unless they've had access to good education and sort of, you know, broad cultural experiences, have deeply problematic racial attitudes. And we don't always have the luxury in the South of just sort of discarding white people or saying we're not going to fool with them just because. And that's interesting in this political landscape where, because of sort of digital technology, you have a whole new generation of young Black activists who are able in many ways to call white folks out and to have some of the most candid conversations on race that we've been able to have in this country in 50 years. And I think that in some ways that shot us in the foot in 2016, because we were so clear about the racism of all of the candidates, even a candidate like Hillary Clinton, that it just made her seem not viable for anyone. And I think the thing you learn in the South is how to distinguish between degrees of racism. You know, it's the difference between the sort of white lady who talks to you not quite right at your office and the white people who have, you know, a Confederate flag and a rifle, you know, in the back of the pickup truck. Like these are not the same. And so we can call it all out. But, you know, I think that this is a continuing battle. I will say this to you, though. One of the things, because I have grown up with white girls for friends and all of that, you know, I try to keep my politic about Black women. I try, you know, a lot of Black women struggle to identify with feminism because they think that it's a thing that white women invented. And they think it's a thing that white women take up too much space in. White women didn't teach me anything about feminism. The first women in my life, from my friends to my professors to introduce it to me, were Black women. And they introduced it to me by talking about the struggles that Black women face and the ways that both Black men in politics and white women, Black men in race politics and white women in feminist politics, never looked at Black women, never considered our issues. And just like we don't walk away from Black men in race politics, even when they manage to not think about us, then I refuse to relinquish feminist politics, a politics about making the world safe for women and girls. I refuse to relinquish that territory to white women because they didn't invent it. You know, Black women have been talking about feminism and feminist politics pretty much since we were talking about how to get free of slavery. We have always said, what will this mean for Black women and girls? And that is my enduring question. What does it look like to make a world that's safe for Black women and girls? What does it look like for Black women and girls to get the love that they need and their families and their partnerships? What does it look like? What does a world look like in which Black women and girls are free? Because whenever we figure that out, if we can figure out how to help Black women and girls be free, then we will figure out how to help everybody be free.
So like I said before, you know, I think that many Black girls can kind of identify with this white elephant in the room, right? Growing up, you know, alongside white women. And I think Dr. Cooper also makes a very great argument in her book when she says that Black people cannot escape whiteness in the South. You know, it's mm-hmm. literally everywhere around us. You know, people can, like, I feel like people in the North can kind of be like, you know, you don't have to associate with this particular population if you feel uncomfortable or if they, you know, say something out of the way. But like for us, that's not a choice. And, you know, we always are compared and devalued when it comes to white women. And I think that's a very hard conversation for Black women to have.
Yeah. So, and even though, like, so some people, I get what you're saying, but some people may not recognize what this looks like. And so I kind of mm-hmm. want to, like, break it down a little bit to where it's like they think mm-hmm. that you're being constantly, like, side by side compared to a white woman, but it can show up in other mm-hmm. ways in your life. So
yeah.
we've seen time and time again that the closer you are to whiteness, the more appreciated, the more beautiful, the more smarter mm-hmm. that people think you are. So this comes through the light-skinned, dark-skinned dolls. And so it's like, mm-hmm. show me the mm-hmm. evil doll, and people point to the Black doll. And so growing up as a dark-skinned girl, I was often mm-hmm. felt like I wasn't enough because I saw these people that were closer to whiteness. Mm-hmm. So they had lighter skin, curlier hair. They were always put mm-hmm. before me, especially on the beauty category. And so this mm-hmm. is something that is very prevalent within the South. And I think it's a conversation that people are starting to bring up more and more in today's age, you know, as far as mm-hmm. calling people out, like, mm-hmm. why do you have no dark skin models?
Yeah.
Where's your dark skin representation? Yeah. And I think it's something beautiful to watch, especially being a dark skinned girl uh-huh. and not necessarily seeing these things when I was growing up, like yeah. not seeing all these dolls, not seeing like
And you know what, Jackie, outside of representation too, I think that Dr. Cooper makes a great point when she's like, the difference between a white man and a white woman is gender. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of that racism can be internalized. And I think that a lot of people forget that, especially within the feminist movement. If you look mm-hmm. at what white feminism is today, it's very like, we are omitted. Women of color are omitted within those movements. And so I think that was a very great point that she brought up in our conversation and in the book.
I agree. And so also in the book, Dr. Cooper talks about activist movements and how other people identify Black scholars, activists, and thinkers in the South. And at the end of the day, she said what she said.
I want to be clear. I'm not impressed with sort of the I'm not impressed with Northern liberal Negroes. Like, I want to be very open about that, because there's a way in which I live on the East Coast now because I teach in New Jersey, and there's a way in which, you know, people are seem only to be progressive on the East Coast, or you have to go out to the West Coast. And I just want to say that I think unequivocally that that's a lie. I have spent most of my life in the South, both working, working and going to school and living. And so I am unequivocally a Southern woman. You know, you can't look, I can outbrew a pot of sweet tea better than anybody. And if you find me on my best country day, then I'm typically somewhere in the country walking around barefoot. And that is who I am at my core. And we can be that and still be politically sophisticated. And we come from, you know, let's remember that radical Black politics in this country very much has Southern roots. Folks forget that, you know, King, Coretta Scott King, Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, all of those folks are people living in Alabama. Like, you know what I mean? And we sometimes forget that there's all of these roots of Southern radicalism. You know, there was this great book about 15 years ago that talked about how there were all these chapters of Marcus Garvey's UNIA that could be found in these little small rural towns in central Louisiana. So not down in New Orleans, which is more urban South, but in the central country, rural parts of the region, there were all these in the early 20th century, all of these sort of radical Black organizations in these little small Southern towns. And so I say that, I know it sounds professorial, but it is a way to say you got radical Black people everywhere. And, you know, and also like in the days when I have struggled sometimes as a Southern Black girl with like, I know the way that Southern politics are influenced by the church and influenced by conservatism. But I want to say to people, I'm a child of these same communities. And so much of my sense of myself doesn't come from, you know, being educated on the East Coast. Not at all. It very much comes from being raised by a grandmama who the first thing when you walked in her house, you saw a rifle in her front door. And she would check, you know, she would get after anybody, whether it was wild animals or law enforcement officers who tried to tell her what she could do on her property. She would take that gun and she would point it at them and she would tell them what was going to happen. So like, that's who I am. That's the sensibility that I bring to this work. That is where my crunkness comes from. That is where my fire comes from. That is where my passion for Black folks comes from. And so I think you're right. I think we really need to let folks know that the South still has something to say, in the words of OutKast. And I'm happy to be able to have these set of conversations in a moment where you do have more writers coming out of the South, Regina Bradley, KSA Lehman. And even look, there's a longer tradition. Bell Hooks was one, you know, is a Southern Black woman who also wrote. She's just, you know, an elder Black woman now. And so I like the fact that I'm a, you know, Black woman in the hip hop generation, raised on very dirty South, ratchet hip hop, who gets to be in these conversations. And I think that's a perspective worth representing for sure.
So this is one of the most empowering parts for me of this conversation. I feel like when it comes to the way people around this country define thinkers in the South, it's what Dr. Cooper said, right? You know, actually today I saw a bumper sticker and it said exactly what I feel like the country thinks of us. It said, you know, we're too dumb for the East Coast and we're too ugly for the West Coast, right? And I think that whenever scholars or just whenever people think about us in general, they don't think that we're smart, right? Because we're grown up in the South, we're in these rural areas, we're in these more conservative areas. But I mean, I feel like it takes people like us, like experiencing those things in order to kind of accurately criticize and think critically about that. What about you?
I definitely agree with everything you said. I have nothing more to add. But I do have to ask you, did you ask her the most important question?
Jackie, I'm so sick of you and your trust issues.
Because it's just even more prevalent because she's back. Like, I mean, we knew she was coming back.
First of all, can we talk about On the Run really quick? You know what? Like, no, we'll wait. I'll wait.
Yeah, we'll wait.
But let me go ahead and say that I did ask, how do you feel about Beyonce?
Now, look, I say it. I'm on record in this book. A quote, Beyonce is my feminist muse. I have been down for Beyonce since the very first Destiny's Child album in 1997. So, you know, people, you know, I still listen to cuts off that album all the time. So Beyonce is my people. She's been my people. I have ridden with her a long time. And so I'm here for everything that the queen does. I'm trying to figure out these tickets to the next concert, the On the Run 2 tour. I'm about it. So
Dr. Brittany Cooper is an associate professor of women's and gender studies and Africana studies at Rutgers University and the author of the recently released Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower.
You can find her on Twitter at Professor Crunk, C-U-R-N-K. Also check out more of her work on her website, www.brittanycooper.com.
And that's Brittany, B-R-I-T-T-N-E-Y.
This past weekend, D'Elia was out at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas, living her best life. She attended the first ever natural hair care picnic during South by at Houston Tillotson, an HBCU in the music capital. The event featured a majority of Black-owned brands in cosmetics, natural hair care, skin care, yoga, and more. D'Elia spoke to Coco Bates, the content creator for Fashion, Beauty, and Culture blog at The Curl Report and the brains behind the Curly Girl Picnic.
Well, I attended South by last year. And I felt, I don't want to say let down because I wasn't really expecting too much from it, but from the topics and panels and sessions that they had, I felt like I was going to get a little bit more out of it just because they talked about topics that were dealing with diversity. They talked about topics that were related to the continent, Africa. But on those panels, there weren't any of us on there. And if we were on the panels, they were very whitewashed. I was trying to choose my words carefully, but they were very safe, and they didn't talk about the topics that really needed to be discussed. Because of that, I felt left out. I felt like there wasn't really a place for me in South By. I have a mission to do for self, and I wanted to do something again this year, but I didn't want to be associated with South By because of their lack of inclusion, and I created the Curly Girl Picnic. You will hear topics on politics, topics that relates to self-love, individuality, loving yourself and being yourself as 100% and authentic as you can. We really did a good job with making sure that all of the vendors, they had a strong core value, they had good products, they didn't have bad ingredients in their products, and that they were Black-owned. I didn't think it was gonna have a big turnout, and I just wanted to do something small and intimate just so I can really talk to women and we can build that bond. And when I post the event on Eventbrite and on Facebook, it just took off. And that really surprised me, but I'm glad it did. I'm glad that I'm able to have those same intentions, but on a bigger scale. And it's still, to me, it still feels like an intimate event, like women feel comfortable to talk to one another. I want this to feel like a big family reunion, family affair. Hey, girl, that type of feel. So this is our safe haven, and we need more of those. Without giving too much, this will be something that, even though it says Curly Girl Picnic, the next year's event, it'll be something that will be marketed towards everybody, the Black family. So the Black men, the Black women, the little Black babies, the Black children, they can come out, have fun. It'll be something for everybody.
You can find Coco on Twitter at @the_coreport and on her blog, www.the-coreport.com.
Dang, man. So we're finally at the end, Jackie. It's about that time.
So, Dalia, what was your to and fro moment this week?
Okay, so this past weekend, I went to NOLA.
Hey.
Got my life in NOLA. And it was great. It was great to be surrounded by Black people. I live in Austin, where the Black population is about 7%. due to gentrification, there has been a shrinkage in Black population. So it was great to not stick out like a sore thumb. It was great to be around people who that I could identify with and not be apologetic in certain spaces. And I think that my to and fro moment is I think I already had a appreciation for being a Black woman in the South, right? But I think this weekend made me appreciate being Black and Southern even more. So, like, we went to, like, the hood side of NOLA, right?
That ninth
and so and so we went to a hole in the wall. And so, like, first we went to a gentrified hole in the wall. Because if y'all don't know, parts of NOLA is being gentrified if you've been out of the loop. And so when we came in, first of all, the girl had an attitude. And, you know, it ruined my mood real quick. So we had to get out of there. But then we like, stumbled upon this this place called the Spotted Zebra, I believe, or like the Green Zebra or something like that. And we went in there. You know, there were older Black people in there. But when I'm telling you, Jackie, when we walked in, like, I never felt so welcomed and so loved. You know what I'm saying? Like, we played pool, we danced, and, you know, nobody looked at us like we were stupid. Nobody looked at us like we were being ghetto. You know what I'm saying? Like, it was just, like, so much love. And I think my to and fro moment is it's just, like, appreciating the Black South and appreciating how, like, Southerners are very welcoming to each other, especially Black Southerners. Like, no matter who you are, we take care of each other. And, yeah, that was my moment. How about you?
Girl, first of all, let me just say I love New Orleans. I go once a year for that exact same moment because the food and the people. Girl. Really, one time I was watching a fight on Bourbon and the people acted like he tried to run and punch the guy. He punched me in the face on accident. But the crazy thing was, is like, I got punched in the face and all these people who didn't know me were like, oh no, baby. They were like, are you okay? Like, and it was so many people came up to me and I was just like, oh, I feel so loved.
Thank
like,
you.
I forgot I got punched in the face. Like, it was so, I was like, oh my God. I literally just booked my hotel to go to New Orleans because one of my friend's mom is getting married. Shout out to Miss Ronnie. So yeah, we're going to a New Orleans wedding. But yes, I'm so happy you had a great time in New Orleans. What else? What did you eat? What's the best thing you ate?
We went to this place called Neo's and it was like amazing. Like the food was great. I had some jambalaya, girl, and then I had some chicken, and then let me tell you, I had the sweetest cornbread. Like we didn't even need dessert after eating that cornbread because it was so good, girl.
Ooh, I'm happy you had a good food. Okay, so my to and fro moment this week is just stay ready so you don't have to get ready.
What?
And that goes towards Beyonce. To all the people that were blindsided at the fact that she was coming back, to all the people that were just like scrambling, like, she gives us no warning. She gave us 2 days, and if you didn't have your money, you just didn't have it. Like,
wait,
listen.
First of all, is this shade to me?
I feel Not at all. This isn't this your first concert?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, fun fact. Did I tell you about the time my mom snuck and went to a Beyonce concert without me?
Oh, that's rude.
Exactly.
That's fighting. That's fighting words.
I mean, we can feature that conversation on the episode one day, but I mean, I'm still a little sore about it, but it's whatever.
Yeah, no, I've been going to Beyonce concerts since Destiny's Child, so I'm not new to this. I'm true to this. So, okay. Like, when things came around, I knew what it was. And a lot of y'all were shaken up. Remember last On the Run when y'all didn't have y'all tours?
Stop.
When you didn't have your pre-sale codes. But I had my pre-sale codes. I had everything. And the moral of the story is just stay ready not to get ready. And it's just Beyonce teaches us so many lessons in life. You should always have everything on
stack
hand.
Your money.
You should always have your money stacked. You should always have everything ready to go that when it is time to go, you're not scrambling around.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
My to and fro moment goes out to the Beyonce people, like to Beyonce and all the people who really love Beyonce and are legit fans around the world.
Yes.
And I can't wait to go to On the Run tour, too.
No, we can't wait. to go to On the Run.
You're right. Because I'm going to have the time of my life.
We're going to have the time of it. You keep omitting me.
And I'm sorry. You know, no, because I bought one ticket. So, like, when people ask me, who are you going with? I'm like, myself.
Wow. I bought me and my mom one. I'm telling you, forgiveness is key. Sometimes you just got to let things
go. I got my mom a ticket to Hamilton.
Oh, that's enough, because I know that was a $300 ticket.
Girl, them tickets was $400. And then I had to turn around and buy Beyonce tickets.
Whoop.
Bro. Anyway. That's why I told you I'm broke. Don't ask me to go nowhere.
Well, that's the end of the show.
Make sure to tell your friends about us. Follow us on Twitter at The To and Fro and like our page on Facebook. Also, if you love the show, please tell your friends and don't forget to rate us on Apple, Google, or wherever you listen to your podcast. And be sure to send us some suggestions you have for the show.
Music by Honey Banks. Follow her on Twitter at Miss Chris Honeybee.
Dalia, do you have anything to leave the people with this week?
Yes. This weekend, after going to New Orleans and eating really good food, I ate some fried chicken, and I was as full as a tick, honey. Let me tell you about it.
What does that even mean?
I don't know. I'm just going with the flow here. Bye.
All right. Bye, y'all.